Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this sunny Saturday morning, December 7th. How are we doing this morning? Hope you're enjoying this holiday season so far and glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 Eastern Standard Time. And you can hear us from anywhere online at 883WPPB.org. 33 degrees and sunny with a high of 36 this afternoon. All right, I can handle that. At least the sun's out, right? I was in the city most of the week, and it is so much fun to see all the Christmas decorations. And you know, I've been a New Yorker since I moved to Manhattan right out of college, originally from Ohio. But to this day, every time I walk around the city and take in all the holiday decorations, it really is like being a kid on Christmas morning. I love it. So beautiful. The buildings, just all the lights and trees and ornaments and decorations and things going on in our great Manhattan. Just really, really special. And that feeling hopefully will carry on for the rest of the month. And so happy holidays to all of you. And lots going on in the sports world as per usual. And you Mets fans have all heard by now that billionaire hedge fund magnate Steve Cohen, who resides in Greenwich, Connecticut, will take over the majority share of the team's ownership. Cohen would increase his existing stake in the Mets through a deal with Sterling Partners, which is the investment firm of the current Mets owners, Fred Wilpon, and his son, Jeff. And under the deal's terms, the Wilpons will remain at the helm of the franchise for a five-year term, with Fred Wilpon continuing to serve as CEO and Jeff Wilpon serving as COO. Well, Bloomberg reports that the Wilpons are in talks to sell up to 80% of the team to Cohen, a deal that values the Mets at $2.6 billion. And Newsday also reported that Cohen will become the Mets' majority owner by 2025. So I guess many Mets fans are ecstatic with this news. Some feel that the ownership has been a nightmare that fans have endured for a while, and that may be gradually ending. Well, we will talk with best-selling author Eric Sherman and get his take on it. Eric's most recent book with Art Chomsky is titled After the Miracle, The Lasting Brotherhood of the 69 Mets. And I'm sure Eric Sherman has an opinion or two about the change in ownership and what that means for the Mets organization. Can't wait to talk to Eric. In the first half of the show, we'll explore a completely different issue, and an issue that I've always been intrigued with, whether or not student athletes should be paid to play college sports. Wow, it is a very heavy topic, lots of sides to it, and longtime friend and colleague Rob DeGeese, who is the president of Iron Horse Marketing, and he's a professor of sports management at the Wharton School. He will join us in a few minutes to talk about the whole issue of compensating college athletes. What's the latest on it? Have the NCAA budged on their stance? Well, the NCAA, as you know, is the nonprofit organization that brings in $1 billion business every year, mostly due to lucrative TV rights and marketing fees. And they've long been criticized for not fairly sharing the cash with the thousands of student athletes across the country. Well, at the end of October, the NCAA announced, in quotes, in the association's continuing efforts to support college athletes, the NCAA's top governing board voted unanimously to permit students participating in athletics the opportunity to benefit from the use of their name, image, and likeness in a manner consistent with the collegiate model. The Board of Governors' action directs each of the NCAA's three divisions to immediately consider updates to relevant bylaws and policies for the 21st century. This was all said by Michael V. Drake, who is the chairman of this board, and he's actually the president of Ohio State University as well. The working group will continue to gather feedback through April on how best to respond to the state and federal legislative environment and to refine its recommendations on the principles and regulatory framework. The board asked each division to create any new rules beginning immediately, but no later than January 2021. So basically, that was their statement at the end of October. And it's pretty vague, to say the least. So we're going to explore what this really means, what this NCAA announcement is really all about, and, you know, what the chances are for this to happen anytime soon. The whole issue of college athletes being paid. We'll talk to Rob DeGeezy, sports management professor at the Wharton School, about this in a few minutes. All right, let's first look at some of the top sports stories in college football. This weekend is very important to determine the Heisman Trophy winner, as AP pointed out in an article. Since the college football playoff started in 2014, four of five Heisman Trophy winners have played on teams selected to play in the semifinals. Well, Heisman Trophy frontrunner Joe Burrow of LSU, he heads into the Southeastern Conference title game today against number four Georgia, with a commanding lead in the Heisman race. Boy, I had the opportunity to watch Burrow in person at the LSU Ole Miss game a few weeks back, and is he ever impressive? Really, really outstanding. And he is on pace to set new NCAA records, one being for a single season completion percentage. So he has he's winning a lot of awards. He's breaking a lot of college records, and you bet I'm going to watch that game today, LSU against number four, Georgia. In tennis, former number one Caroline Wozniacki says she will retire from professional tennis after competing in Melbourne at the Australian Open coming up in January 2020. The 29-year-old from Denmark says she would like to start a family with her husband, who's former NBA player David Lee, and work to raise awareness about rheumatoid arthritis. Wozniacki has earned over $35 million in prize money. She won the 2018 Australian Open. She's compiled 30 career titles overall. In golf, Gary Woodland leads Henrik Stenson by one shot after two rounds in Tiger Woods' Hero World Challenge at the Albany Club down in the Bahamas. Woodland finished birdie-birdie to move to 13-under, Stenson is at 12 under. Tiger Woods, Justin Thomas, and John Rahm are all at 11 under, two shots back, tied for third place. Meanwhile, Patrick Reed, I don't know if you saw the video of this, but yesterday he improved his lie out of a bunker twice and got penalized, rightly so, two strokes. While taking a practice swing twice, his club hit the sand and improved his lie, said the judges. It bumped him down from tied for second place, to sixth place, and could be the reason he doesn't win the golf tournament. I just don't know what Patrick Reed is thinking. The rules had changed last year in golf, where you can touch the sand with your club, but you can't improve your lie. And so when he was taking the two practice swings, he did move sand, which the judges ruled did, in fact, improve his lie. So he was penalized two strokes, which is a big deal, as you know, in golf. Meanwhile, Jordan Spieth, he's in 14th place at the Hero World Challenge, 2 under overall. Now, Jordan did not qualify this year for the President's Cup, which actually takes place soon. Next week, I think they head right to Australia. Tiger Woods is a player captain. And Jordan did not make the team. He has actually been winless in 2.5 years, which is really surprising because he was so talented, and he is so talented. But, you know, when he was 21 in 2015, he won back-to-back majors. He won the Masters. He won the U.S. Open. His last victory was this 2017 British Open Championship. Well, now, Jordan, having been winless in over 2.5 years, he's ranked 44. And it's really hard for him to deal with not making the President's Cup team. I mean, he's used to being among the top golfers in the world. And, you know, so he's going to, he said he's not actually going to watch it because it hurts him so much that he's not on that team. And finally, in the NBA, the Knicks, well, they're 4-18. And so they fired head coach David Fizdale yesterday. Both Fizdale and assistant coach Keith Smart were ousted. Another assistant, Mike Miller, was promoted to interim head coach. They are in the midst of an 8-straight-game losing streak. They have the worst record in the Eastern Conference after finishing with the worst season in the NBA last season, which was Fizdale's first season. All right, we're going to take a break, come back. Let me tell you that Sports Interview with Anne Liguori is brought to you in part by Dune Jewelry and my Hamptons Rope Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. That's Dune, D-U-N-E, jewelry.com. And by Peak Vision Sunglasses, P-E-A-K Vision Sunglasses, zero distortion, unmatched clarity, change your game, peakvision.com.
Join us for Sundays on the East End with Bridget Leroy and Alex Sokolow, a free-flowing conversation with musicians, magicians, artists, writers, scientists, and other local people who cast their own interesting shadows across the East End. Like us on Facebook to see who's coming up on Sundays on the East End with Bridget Leroy and Alex Sokolow every Sunday at 11 a.m. here on 88.3 WPPB-FM, Long Island's only NPR station.
Hello, everyone. This is Mark Edwards, host of Sock Hop Saturday Night, heard from 8 p.m. until midnight right here on WPPV. Great oldies from the 50s and early 60s. Rock and roll, rhythm and blues, doo-wop, along with your request and dedication. 4 solid hours of music and memories with me, Mark Edwards, right here on WPPV, 88.3 FM, Long Island's only local NPR and public radio station.
Welcome back to Sports Interview on this beautiful Saturday morning. So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 Eastern Standard Time. And you can hear us from anywhere on the planet online by going to 883wppb.org. Each show is turned into a podcast distributed via Audio Boom. And each show is archived on my website at annliguori.com. And I'd like to say good morning to longtime friend and colleague Rob DeGeese, President Iron Horse Marketing Professor, Sports Management at the Walton School. Good morning, Rob. Thanks so much for coming on Sports Interview.
Good morning, Ann. It's a pleasure to be here.
It was good to see you also at the Resident Magazine cover party, but I had no time to talk to anybody. I felt so bad. You don't understand how bad I felt because I know you came a long way to say hello.
Yeah, well, it was great. It was met plenty of your friends, and that was pretty good, too.
So well, I was so honored that you came. And, boy, you've had quite the career and continued to rock and roll. And tell me about your work now at the Wharton School.
I teach the sports management class to both undergrads and MBA students. I've been involved at Wharton since graduating there myself in 1993. And I had previously taught from 2003 to 2005 in the marketing department, focused on sports and entertainment marketing, really movies, music, television, and sports. And then in 2018, when Professor Scott Rosner moved over to Columbia University to run their master's program, they asked me to come back and take over these classes at Wharton. So in addition to teaching these classes, I help the students with various career interests, mentoring sort of things. I helped put on the Wharton Board Sports Business Summit, which just happened on November 8th. And then I'm also involved with our high school enrichment program over the summer, where 100 high school students from all around the world come in for a four-week crash course on the sports business. So I have my hands in a lot of different things there.
You must love it. I mean, it's just so cool to be in touch with, well, I'm sure you have students of all ages, right? Not just young students, but
tell me
a little bit about the demographics of your classes.
Yeah, well, the undergrads are obviously, you know, typical college age, 18 to 22. And I teach, Wharton positions itself differently than some of these sports programs. I am teaching a general business student, and in many cases, I would say 30-40% of my students are general liberal arts students. And they just have a interest in the sports business and want to learn a little bit more about it. I'm always shocked about how little they know coming into it. Things that, you know, a dedicated sports fan, or they're all dedicated sports fans, but they just have never explored the business side of things. Now, my other students, which I'm very excited about for this spring, the MBA students, I get 60 of them. The average age of a Wharton MBA student upon matriculation is 28. And so they come in with 6 years of experience. They are already out in the business world and understanding the dynamics of business situations. And they too are, you know, most of them are going into investment banking or consulting, healthcare management or brand management. And so they are looking for just a little extra enrichment. Every semester I get about less than 10 students who are looking for their first job out of school to be in the sports industry.
That's great. I mean, I'm sure these young people keep you on your toes. I mean, you probably bring so much of your experience and knowledge to the game, obviously, but boy, you have to really be up with everything, right?
Absolutely. It's terrific. I often tell them, it's great that you're here to learn, but no one learns more than me. I learn from them. One of the best things I do is I have a research paper, so in the spring I'm going to have 130 papers to read, all on very interesting topics. Yes, I get my handful of the same topics over and over again, but there's always someone that enlightens me on something I don't know anything about, a paper on Indian cricket or a paper on F1 or E1, which is car racing with electronic cars, things like that, that is really expanding my own knowledge base. They're very sharp. They're very thorough and dedicated, especially at a school like Penn or Wharton.
Sure.
They've done a lot of those things to get there, so it's great being in that environment.
And if you switch places and put yourself back to being in your 20s and earlier, you know, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have such immediate access to information. We had to go to the library and check out books. And most young people don't even know what that is anymore. Right?
No, they don't need to go to a different building to go to the library. That's
exactly.
For sure.
So, I mean, they're so smart. They just, because they've had this information at their fingertips, since they were born, basically, right?
Absolutely. And they, but they're very good with data and quantitative support. And I think, you know, especially the juniors and seniors, Wharton trains them to not make a business case unless you have compelling data to support it. Nothing is just going to be a call-in show, just offering a sports fan's opinion. You have to really break things down and create a recommendation, knowing that it's not perfect. There's no recommendation that's perfect, but based on my analysis, this is what I would recommend. And so I get that while applying to the sports industry. So it's a great experience for everyone involved.
Well, I'm sure you talk a lot about the NCAA in your classes, mm-hmm. the nonprofit organization, just bringing in billions of dollars in revenue from lucrative TV rights and marketing fees. And so the issue has been for a long time, should student athletes be paid? And when I read the announcement that the NCAA basically released at the end of October, it's so vague. I mean, they say they want to support college athletes. The NCAA's top governing board voted unanimously to permit students participating in athletics the opportunity to benefit from the use of their name, image, and likeness in a manner consistent with the college model. They're directing each of the NCAA's three divisions to immediately consider updates to relevant bylaws and policies. And they basically want all this in effect no later than January 2021, but they don't really say anything else. I mean, what do you make of all this?
Well, the California law, the Fair Pay to Play Act, really was the final spark that got the NCAA to move and start addressing that. And so I think that announcement in October was really more about we're taking this very seriously. We've put a working group together led by Gene Smith, the athletic director at Ohio State, and Val Ackerman, the commissioner of the Big East, to address the next steps. Because you could imagine there's over 1,000 NCAA college and universities in the country. And so to get all those groups on board with a process is a very complex thing. Everybody has different agendas and different objectives. There's a lot of complexity within an individual school, from the revenue-generating sports like football, basketball, to some degree hockey, to some degree baseball. And then addressing that with the bulk of the nearly 500,000 college athletes playing at any given time, from down to, you know, a Division III wrestling team or you know, women's lacrosse team at a minor school. Those things all have to be addressed, and they the NCAA's overall objective is to make athletics a vital part of the educational experience and make sure there is a clear demarcation between the college athlete and the professional athlete. And so it's a very complex thing. They have released a timeline where the final vote will happen in January of 2021, but there are about 6 milestones throughout 2020 to address that. And they're getting pushed. I mean, California introduced this law that Gavin Newsom signed in late September, and since that time, 7 additional states have proposed laws, not passed. Only California has passed, and then there are 11 other states who are very close to proposing laws to be voted on. So all that has happened in about 2 months. So they're really forcing action here, and we're going to see significant change because, you know, NCAA has been around for over 100 years. It was established under the direction of Teddy Roosevelt. And so it takes a little while for them to change. But to give them a break, it's a very complex operation and a very complex issue.
Street & Smith's Sports Business Journal covers it pretty extensively in their latest issue. What's in a Name? Marketing Rights for College Athletes Coming Sharply into Focus in 2020. Liz Mullen did a piece where it talks about California governor speaking out on Fair Pay to Play Act. Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, turned the state's Fair Pay to Play Act, which will allow student athletes to sell their name, image, and likeness, into law on September 30th in a very public way, signing the bill actually on LeBron James' show on HBO, which was a smart move. So yes, he's kind of kick-started this whole movement, and as you say, these other states are following. So is it going to be, it's no longer going to be determined state by state now that the NCAA said that they are willing to look at this?
Right. They're trying to maintain the competitive balance, to use a term popular in professional sports, among all those NCAA schools. If California were to just have this here, there would be an advantage for those California schools in recruiting.
Sure.
So they need to create a program that is applicable, that all the states agree to as well. So just imagine the complexity of that. It's not just 1,000-plus universities. It's 50 states agreeing to a general framework, or maybe even specifics, in order to roll this thing out.
So right. I mean, so look at all the different programs. You look at the sports that really bring in the bulk of the money, obviously college football, college basketball. So how, and some theories are you just pay those athletes.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's not going to fly. You know that.
No.
On many campuses, you know, the women's sports, they're not going to like that. The other, men's sports that aren't college football, that aren't college basketball, they're going to say, well, what about us? So how is the NCAA going to handle that? That alone is a huge problem.
Absolutely. Obviously, with Title IX and whatnot, you need equal opportunity for both men and women's sports, and equal opportunity can be defined in more ways than just the number of scholarships that are available. And the athletes are already separate from the student body. Paying them can make them even more separate. They often have different dorms, different dining halls, benefits, tutors, and whatnot. They have a very tough time schedule. Since I have been teaching this time, I have greatly elevated my respect for the student athlete and highly recommend people hiring them because they have mastered time management and the ability to prioritize all the things on their plate. And that's different. You know, there is a difference between the Division III athlete and the Division I athlete in terms of time for travel. But as far as day-to-day, Monday through Friday, preseason and whatnot, the commitment is very close as far as the time commitment and the intensity and that you must, you know, put basketball first or put fencing first, whatever it might be. And so I think the NCAA is going to be very careful to make sure that they don't separate the revenue-generating athletes more than the general athlete population. They're already trying to make sure that their athletes are not that different from the general population of students, let alone then make a division because you're in a revenue-generating sport. You know, I spoke this week to a guy who played at a big ACC school, and he said one of the biggest surprises to him is at graduation he had to go to the bookstore in order to pick up his cap and gown. And so he's a senior, you know, a month away from graduating. He didn't know where it was because everything was handed to them. He didn't have the books. They had people doing it. He had to get on the intercampus bus system. First time he had to do it because everything else was being driven around by grad assistants on golf carts. So it's a different experience for the big-time college athlete versus the regular student.
My guest is Rob DeGiese, President, Iron Horse Marketing, Professor, Sports Management at the Wharton School. And Rob, you know, the big question is, so where does the money come from? Does the NCAA pay for these athletes out of all this revenue they're getting from the TV rights? Do the specific colleges pay these athletes? And, you know, there is an argument that the scholarships are worth a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So if they take the scholarships away and start paying these athletes, the athletes will be taxed on that money. That's another issue.
They'll be taxed on that money. They'll want to unionize. They'll have workers' comp issues. They're going to be treated like any other employee, like a staff person at the university. And where does the money come from is absolutely a big issue. You know, there's a big, I think, a headline type of understanding, that's a term I like to use. They say, well, the NCAA generates $1 million. Most of that money, 85%, is from their media rights deal with CBS and Turner for March Madness. And so all that money, after expenses, gets distributed to those 1,000 schools. So you got $1 billion after expenses, you might have, you know, $700 million, and then that's going to a thousand schools. And so all that money goes into support the non-revenue-generating school sports. You know, a big school like Texas and Texas A&M generate over $200 million from their athletics department, and they spend just under $200 million. So there's not a lot of extra profits that could then start be funneling down to the students. There are certainly constraints and issues that can be alleviated, and there's opportunities here for corporate, you know, outside parties, local businesses, corporations who want to use their name, image, and likeness to provide some additional compensation for those athletes. But then again, that's got to be a very careful thing to make sure you maintain that amateur status as well as not set up a situation ripe for fraud or corruption.
Right. Maybe you can enlighten my audience, excuse me, on the Bannon lawsuit and what happened there with the likeness controversy.
Sure.
Because
sure.
That see, I'm against college athletes being paid. Mm-hmm. I was against professional athletes entering the Olympic arena. I just think Olympics are for amateur mm-hmm. athletes, and even professionals have their sports to compete in.
Yep.
I just think there's too fine a line between, you know, these professionals, you know, the professional athlete and the collegiate athlete. Let the collegiate world, you know, continue to focus on amateur athletes. Now, should they get a stipend to pay for their books, et cetera, yes, through scholarships. And mm-hmm. maybe they need more money to pay for some things. You know what I'm saying? Maybe that has to be reexamined. But I don't think they should be paid. But I do believe that if your image is used in, say, a video game, like what happened with Bannon, right? You know, then yeah, definitely that is an issue where they just can't use somebody's likeness and profit from it, an outside organization. So maybe you can explain that whole lawsuit.
Absolutely. And especially in Ed O'Bannon's case, EA and the NCAA were using the name, image, and likeness of a player who had left college 20 years earlier.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so, you know, Ed O'Bannon was part of the UCLA team in 1995. He's had his couple years in the NBA, a few years in European professional basketball. Mm-hmm. And then so by his mid-40s, he's working at a car dealership, and he noticed a friend of his son was playing EA Sports college basketball game, and there was a guy with his playing style, with his skin tone, with his number on you playing for UCLA. And Ed said, oh, I'm not getting any money out of this. And there are thousands of athletes, long after their college eligibility has ended, who were part of this EA game. And they had a lawsuit against the NCAA and Electronic Arts, and ultimately that ended in a settlement for $40 million, where that money was distributed out to some players. But what it also resulted in is EA said, this is not going to be a profitable venture for us. We're going to focus on other properties to engage the video gaming market, and they stopped doing college basketball video games. And but what that did was really open up the awareness that there is a opportunity for a player to be compensated for his name, image, and likeness, just like you or I could be. Someone, you know, if Coca-Cola wanted to do a deal with me to feature them in all their ads nationally, they'd be crazy to do that. I would get compensated for the use of my name, image, and likeness. They're profiting off it. They're executing a commercial purpose and using assets and intellectual property I own just because of everybody has name, image, and likeness.
What's your opinion on it, Rob? Do you think college athletes should be paid?
I think college athletes receive an incredible benefit as it is now. A lot of people talked about Zion Williamson. Well, what he's done for Duke. Well, what has Duke done for Zion Williamson? He was on national TV every week. He signed a mega deal with the Jordan brand, and he receives plenty of benefit. And the one besides Zion Williamson, like I said, the everyday lacrosse player or wrestler, they get an incredible opportunity for colleges that approach $100,000 a year. They get great benefit. Now, maybe because of the time commitment required, they can't complete their education in 4 years, and they might not be able to do it in 5 years. So maybe there is some kind of revised model that can help them benefit from that education and springboard into the rest of their life, not just from what they learn, but the community that they are a part of, the social skills that they've learned, the time management skills that they've learned. So there's plenty of benefit there. But like you said, there's plenty of adjustments that can be made. A college athlete may not have the pocket money to get his hair cut or to go out for pizza with his friends because he has no time to earn extra money. There's all kinds of restrictions in college athletes about how he can use his athletic prowess and celebrity to earn money. For example, someone on the golf team giving golf lessons and getting paid $50 an hour to give golf lessons. He's prohibited from doing that. I think that the NCAA can loosen the reins a little bit, but I agree with you that the college and educational experience is much more. If you start paying athletes, then this turns into no more than a licensing deal. The athletic team is going to license Villanova or license Ohio State to be the name associated with a professional team. And then you've completely changed the essence of college sports.
And then obviously another argument is, well, these top athletes in college could get injured. Like, look what happened to the Alabama quarterback.
Yep.
His career may be over. I mean, here's the guy who is the Heisman Trophy candidate, right?
Right.
And his
and the number one pick in the draft.
Number one pick in the draft, potentially. And his college, it's very doubtful now how he's going to bounce back, if he will bounce back. So
There,
you know, people who are in favor of paying college football, you know, will bring up this young man's name and say, gosh, you know, he had this opportunity, you know, to sign this pro contract. Why don't they pay these kids in college? Because what happens if they get injured and they can't go on to earn big bucks in the professional ranks?
And he is the one example of, like I said, nearly 500,000 college athletes. and there's always going to be different individual stories. So that alone does not put the argument in that he should get paid. He certainly would not have gotten paid. There are ways for college athletes to get insurance policies. When Zion Williamson broke through his sneaker, his basketball shoe, there was all talk about should he sit out the rest of the year. He actually, if his career was ended, he has an insurance policy that was paid for by Duke. So, you know, he would have done quite well if he ended his basketball career at 19 because of that injury, much more than any other 19-year-old, that's for sure.
Rob DeGizzi, it's a pleasure to have you on Sports Interview. Thank you so much, and we'll continue the discussion in the future. Hope so. Thank you.
Terrific. Thanks for having me on, Ann. Great to speak to you.
Rob DeGizzi, President, Iron Horse Marketing, Professor, Sports Management at the Wharton School. All right, we're going to take a quick break and shift gears and talk a little bit about the future of the Mets ownership, what that scenario is going to be like. Eric Sherman, who wrote another bestseller with Art Shansky, titled After the Miracle, The Lasting Brotherhood of the 69 Mets. I'm sure he has an opinion or two about all of this, though. Eric Sherman will join us right after I tell you that. Sports Interview with Ann LaGoria is brought to you in part by Dune Jewelry and My Hamptons Robe Collection. Savor the memories with sand from your favorite beach or golf course in timeless pieces for men and women. Dune, DUNEJewelry.com, and by Peak Vision Sunglasses. Zero distortion, unmatched clarity. Change your game. Peak Vision, P-E-A-K, Vision.com.
Hello, everyone. This is Mark Edwards, host of Sock Hop Saturday Night, heard from 8 p.m. until midnight right here on WPPV. Great oldies from the 50s and early 60s, rock and roll, rhythm and blues, doo-wop, along with your request and dedication. 4 solid hours of music and memories with me, Mark Edwards, right here on WPPV, 88.3 FM, Long Island's only local NPR and public radio station.
Love live jazz? You can hear the Jam Session Radio Hour right here on NPR member station 88.3 WPPB, Wednesday nights at 7. The Jam Session has returned to Sag Harbor to Ed's Lobster Bar at 1742 Sag Harbor Turnpike every Thursday night starting at 6:30. Join us for the Jam Session live on Thursdays at Ed's Lobster Bar and on the Jam Session Radio Hour Wednesday nights at 7, and stay tuned to 88.3 WPPB for the best in local public radio.
Hi, I'm Gianna Volpe. I play music that rocks, invite you to East End events that rule, and talk with people all over our Twin Forks on The Heart of the East End, 9 to noon, Mondays through Fridays, on Long Island's only NPR station, 88.3 FM, WPPB, or online at 883WPPB.org.
Welcome back to Sports Interview with Ann LaGoria on this beautiful Saturday morning. And so glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning from 9 to 10 Eastern Standard Time. You can hear us from anywhere online at 883WPPB.org. Each show is distributed on podcast via Audio Boom. And each show is also archived on my website at annlagoria.com. Well, we are going to talk a little New York Mets. They were in the news big time this week, and who better to talk about it than best-selling author Eric Sherman, whose most recent book with Art Shamsky is titled After the Miracle, The Lasting Brotherhood of the 69 Mets. Good morning, Eric Sherman. Thanks for joining me here in Sports Interview.
Well, thank you, Ann, and I love the intro music, the holiday music. It's certainly Christmas time for the Mets. My goodness, with this huge news.
I love it. Well, before we go into that huge news, I do want to talk a little bit about your book, because it's done so well, and it's my my mistake for not having you on months ago, because it came out a while ago. But I just saw Art Shamsky at the March of Dimes Sports Luncheon, and you guys have been all over the place. So tell me a little bit about this book. I know it really reflects on how the 1969 season transformed the Mets into a World Series winning team. And I love the whole reunion idea when you went out to Tom Seaver's vineyard, basically. Tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. So Art and I, we got together and we talked about an angle that we could use to write a book about the 50th anniversary of the 69 Mets. And, you know, and there have been so many books written about that team, well over 20. And so we needed an angle. And but we knew that with Tom Seaver, because of his condition, he suffered from Lyme disease for a number of years and had suffered with memory loss. This was even before the dementia news that sadly came out early this year. And we knew that we'd have to go out to see him to interview him for the book. And so I said to Art, well, how about we do this? How about not just us go and see him, but since Tom can't come back to New York to celebrate with his teammates at Citi Field, this past summer, why don't we bring the celebration to him? So we brought Jerry Kuzman, flew him in down from Wisconsin, Ron Swoboda from New Orleans, and Art and I, we took Buddy Harrelson with us from New York, and it was just a magical day on Tom's vineyard, and we had lunch afterwards, and nobody wanted to leave, and I really think it's because, you know, these guys realized that it was the last time they were all going to be together, and it was just a beautiful trip, and so that was really, the angle of the book. Although we did interview everybody else associated with the team in the middle chapters of the book, but the spine of the book, the beginning and the end, that was the journey itself and how magical that was.
Oh my goodness, what a heartwarming story. I mean, I could just imagine that reunion and how excited everybody was to see each other and to reminisce. And now, did you just have a tape recorder and just record everything, a digital recorder, or what did... I'm sure you didn't want to miss one word of what was being said, right?
Well, you know, they knew why I was out there, obviously, we were stuck in traffic from San Francisco Airport. You know, I was driving this big van. Kuzman was shotgun, next to me, and I had Shamsky, Swoboda, and Harrelson in the back.
And, oh my goodness!
And you know, we were stuck in traffic for nearly 3 hours getting up to the Napa Valley on a Friday afternoon, and we never put the radio on. You know, these guys just talked and reminisced, and even Buddy, you know, who was at the beginnings of Alzheimer's. He remembered the old days just fine, and he was a part of it, and it was just magical. And these guys, after all these years, it was like no time had passed at all. So I was a fly on the wall for the most part, although they did make me feel very, very welcome. And so in the car, you know, I'm trying to remember things and even scribbling some notes
while you were driving.
and then I also recorded a lot of it on my phone, and I didn't want to miss some of these great stories, and it was just a weekend of nonstop wonderful tales from 69 and beyond.
What story surprised you the most, would you say?
I think there were a couple of, when you write a book, you want to try to find history that's never been told.
Sure.
And it actually came in a couple of forms. You know, Kuzman said that Gil Hodges, when the ball rolled into the dugout in the decisive game of the World Series, the shoe pop polish play, Kuzman said that Gil Hodges told Kuz, rub the ball on your spike, to get shoe pop polish on it. It's not to say that the ball didn't hit Cleon. You know, Cleon said it did, but they just wanted to make sure that Jones would get on first base because they were losing 3-0 at the time and they need base runners. Al Weiss told us that he used a souvenir bat to have, you know, the great World Series that he did. It was a real bat, but it was meant for getting autographs and was distributed by a competing bat company. You know, they were licensed to use this one bat company. This was with the other one. And he said, I don't care, I'm using it. You know, he tried it in batting practice and loved it, and he ended up winning the Babe Ruth Award of the World Series.
With this bat, that's right.
with this bat that he was supposed to just use to get autographs on.
Right.
And there are a lot of revelations like that.
Uh-huh.
But your show's not long enough today, and I know that you want to get to the Mets news.
Right, that's why you have to go and buy After the Miracle, the Lasting Brotherhood of the 69 Mets. And, you know, I covered the Mets when they won the World Series in 1986 for ABC Radio Sports Network, right? And so that team is the team that I'm most familiar with. You know, and the camaraderie of that team, Eric, was just incredible, right? You know, with Keith Hernandez would hold court in the locker room and talk about, you know, his Civil War story, you know, history. He was such a Civil War buff, right? History buff. And Gary Carter, you know, I'd ask him a question and you could basically leave the room and come back and he'd still be talking like an hour later, right? And, you know, Wally Backman and Ray Knight. And, you know, that was a really special team. You know, a lot of blood and guts, and they had that special camaraderie. Would you compare that team to perhaps the brotherhood of the 69 Mets?
It's very different. So I did three books with the 86 Mets.
Okay.
Kings of Queens with most all of them. Then I did Mookie Wilson's and Davey Johnson's memoirs. So I've gotten to know those guys really, really well. And they were very different. The 69 Mets came out of nowhere, really. I mean, the only guy that had confidence that they could be competitive really was Gil Hodges. And he had guys like Jerry Grody that thought they could be a 500 team. And it was based solely on the starting pitching. But they really did come out of nowhere. They were, you know, last place or next to last place all those years. The 86 Mets were built to win in 86. And as far as the players' personalities, you know, I think it starts right at the top with the managers. Gil Hodges ran the clubhouse, you know, like the Marine that he was. And, you know, the players were a little fearful of him, to be very honest about it. They kind of walked on pins and needles around Hodges, you know, as much as they loved and respected him. I mean, he was a father figure at just 47 or 45 years old in 69, whereas Davey Johnson was what they would call a player's manager.
Sure, very relaxed and easygoing.
Right.
And
yeah,
certainly,
you know,
not the Marine type.
No. No, I mean, Davey should just show up to play, and, you know, as long as staying out half the night didn't affect your performance on the field, he could care less. He treated them like men, whereas I think Hodges treated the Mets more like boys.
Interesting, yeah. So big differences there. Well, let's fast forward to today, and a couple of days ago, it was announced that Steve Cohen, billionaire hedge fund magnate, will take over the majority share of the team's ownership. What do you know about Steve? And let's talk about what the implications may be.
Well, you know, I think it's the biggest news for the Mets since 1980, when the group led by Doubleday bought the team for, I think it was just $22 million. You know, today the team's worth $2 billion. But anyway, the Mets have been the little brother to the Steinbrenner family-led Yankees forever. But that changes now with Steve Cohen taking this 80% stake in the Mets. What I know about him, he's a big believer in data. So kind of think Moneyball with lots of money. He's a risk taker. His hedge funds, they've bet on startups, and And his idol was Muhammad Ali. And, you know, Ali, of course, took plenty of risks in his life for what he believed in. So, you know, I think this changes everything in New York and baseball if he gets approved by the other owners. And, you know, and I don't think this is necessarily a slam dunk. I mean, he's his hedge fund. They did plead guilty to insider trading charges 6 or 7 years
ago.
Right,
I remember reading about that.
Yeah. However, if Cohen is going to spend big in the free agent market, he's going to go over the salary cap, he's going to pay luxury taxes, and that'll put money in the other owners' pockets. Now, it's also going, so that'll make them happy, but it'll also increase salaries in baseball, which will make it harder for the lesser wealthy teams to really compete. So it'll be interesting to see how quickly he gets approved. But, you know, there's just been a cloud over the Mets since the Bernie Madoff scandal. The Wilpons and the Katz families had something like $500 million with Madoff, and it's always been kind of murky how much they lost or gained. I think they were both a defendant and plaintiff in the case, but anyway, they've run the Mets like a small market for a decade now, since the Madoff scandal, and that'll end. that will definitely end, with Cohen taking an 80% stake in the club.
Now, you said it's not a done deal, obviously, and under the terms, the Wilpons would remain at the helm of the franchise for a 5-year term. So Fred Wilpon would continue to serve as CEO. Jeff Wilpon would continue to serve as COO. And this, you know, Cohen would become the Mets' majority owner by 2025. So we're still talking a 5-year period here, right?
Yeah, I don't really buy into that. I think, you know, that might be bantied about now. But I don't see how, if somebody owns 80% of something, that they're not going to be making the decisions ultimately, and they're not going to be leading the charge in the free agent market. And, you know, I mean, you're talking about someone that's, now I realize he's worth about $11 billion, but still, you know, if you're investing $2 billion in something, you know, you're going to want to be a part of the decision-making process. And I just don't, I just can't wrap my arms around the fact that he's going to have 80% ownership of the Mets, and he's not going to be involved in pretty much every decision that they make. So, I mean, if it's true, then yeah, then I guess we wait 5 years before we see major changes. But I don't buy that for a minute. I really don't.
I mean, when you look at the numbers out there with these teams, you know, $2.6 billion. It's unbelievable, right? What these franchises are worth.
It is, and everyone talks about the decline in interest in baseball and the death of baseball. You know, basketball now is. I gave a lecture at a college a few weeks ago, and I asked the class, mostly 18 to 20-year-olds, how many baseball games they've watched in the last year. Or, no, I asked them, has anyone in class watched a baseball game in the last year? Nobody raised their hands. And then I asked the same question about basketball. They all raised their hands. Hmm. So the question begs, well, okay, so if baseball has lost a lot of the youth interest, why are the values of these clubs still going up and up and up? And, of course, you know, it's television revenues, it's merchandising, ticket prices. People like you and I that grew up, you know, with baseball as the national pastime, you know, we're the ones that are going to the games, and our colleagues and friends and, you know, people of our age group, you know, are paying the astronomical ticket prices, especially in the Northeast. So, it's tough to say if this trend is going to continue, but it certainly is remarkable how the Mets went from being a $22 million team in 1980 to, as you said, $2.6 billion today. Right, it's incredible.
And toward your point, Eric Sherman, you know, you have to ask, what would the motivation be for an owner like this to come in as, you know, the audiences are waning. Young kids don't really watch baseball anymore. So all I can think of, it has to be ego. I mean, this guy obviously has so much money that dropping, you know, this particular amount of money is not a big deal for him, right? So it must just be he wants to be involved as the majority leader, wants to make the decisions, wants to, you know, from an ego standpoint, maybe he wants to be the guy. I can't think of anything else that would want, if the ratings are declining and the attendance is declining in baseball, what would be his motivation?
Oh, he's a fan. You know, he's been a Mets fan since, you know, 62, when, you know, the team started in the Polo Grounds, and he apparently was one of those fans that went to the Polo Grounds to see the Mets play those first two seasons of their history. And, you know, he's one of these billion-dollar owners, you know, like a Jerry Jones that, you know, grew up loving a team, and now he gets to own them. And so it's definitely ego, and you know, the Mets are, you know, the ultimate toy for the billionaire who has everything.
That's it. That's exactly right. My sentiment, exactly. So what's next for you, Eric Sherman? You always are working on some exciting project, right?
Well, yeah, I just finished a manuscript on the other side of the story in 86 with the 86 Red Sox. So I basically followed the same formula that I did with Kings of Queens, where I traveled around the country and visited with the key and most intriguing players from the 86 Red Sox to get their perspective on what that October of 86 meant to them and how that changed their lives. You know, of course, what happened to them at the hands of the Mets, they did to the Angels just a week and a half before, where, you know, they were one strike away from losing and going home. They come back and they win the pennant, and then they're one strike away against ending a World Series against the Mets, and then the Mets with furious comeback in Game 6 and Game 7. So how they lived with that and how that affected their lives. And it's a pretty interesting story, and there's a lot there that's new and fresh, and so I really enjoyed working on that.
I bet you did. I can't wait to read that one. I lived that World Series, covered that series.
Yeah.
Who can forget Game 6 for ABC Radio Sports Network? And I have some stories of my own I can share with you for sure. Eric, thank you so much. We're wrapping up the show here. Always a pleasure to visit with you, and all the best with everything. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you, Ann. Thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Continued success with his After the Miracle, the Lasting Brotherhood of the 69 Mets. And my thanks to Rob DeGeezy as well. And to our brilliant engineer, Kyle Lynch. Love to make him blush. Have a wonderful weekend. Happy holidays. Talk to you next Saturday right here on Sports Interview with Ann LaGorrie.